recently wrote that O'Casper was the splendid table. Today we talk about taste with naturalist Diane Ackerman, author of A Natural History of the Senses and Deep Play. She points out taste always has double meanings and is the most intimate of all of our senses. Think about it. We actually put what we're tasting into our bodies, and how we taste is as individual as a fingerprint. Jane and Michael Stern, I'm afraid to tell you guys this, but they're back in Chicago. John Willoughby says the best place to travel for people who love to eat is Hong Kong. Minimalist cook Mark Bittman streamlines red pepper puree. And as always, it's open lines for your calls. All this coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today we're going to focus on the idea of taking something basic, found in every market across the country, and improvising some fast and easy meals with it. I'm talking about a 28-ounce can of whole peeled tomatoes. In my book, tomatoes are pretty remarkable. I think of them as a secret weapon. They taste great on their own. It's hard to think of anything that doesn't taste good with a tomato sauce. And in everyday home cooking, when we're using up leftovers or improvising from what we pick up in the supermarket, tomatoes solve problems. Think of it this way. If a dish is blah or lackluster, try a little tomato. They give things life. Add a little tomato to soups or stews, even foods that you're roasting. Tomatoes are one of those foods that make other foods taste better. Of course, magic happens when you mix tomatoes with any kind of carbohydrate, like pasta, breads, whole grains, or beans. My theory is that there's a chemical reaction in our systems to this combination. The carbohydrates lull us with serotonin happiness, while the sweet, tart, meaty tomatoes throw a party of flavors. Want to get the kids and the meat and potato types in the family to eat healthier? Go for tomatoes and whole grain carbs. But let's get back to that 28-ounce can. What should we look for in the supermarket? Read the label and look for four or five things. It should say in the ingredients section, whole tomatoes, tomato juice, salt, citric acid, and possibly calcium chloride. By the way, calcium chloride is a firming agent, and very little of it is used. Don't buy crushed or pureed tomatoes. They could have poor quality tomato paste in the mix, and that tastes metallic. My favorite brands aren't imports. Yes, I was devoted to Italy's San Marzano tomato until I started doing comparative tastings around the country. In most cases, American brands won out, like the organic Muir Glen, or Hunt's, or Contadina, or Red Pack. So now that you've got your tomatoes, let's make some fast weeknight meals. The all-time favorite is the one-dish meal of pasta with tomato sauce. Here's one of the easiest sauces I know of. Everything goes into the pot almost at once and cooks together. Mince up some garlic and some onion and about 12 or so fresh basil leaves. Film the bottom of a 4-quart pot with olive oil, set it over medium heat, and drop in everything and swish it around for a few seconds. Add the tomatoes and simmer uncovered about 25 minutes or until the sauce is thick. Now that's the amount of time you're going to need to boil the pasta, set the table, and pour the wine. One 28-ounce can makes enough sauce for about 3/4 of a pound of pasta. Now, obviously, you can change the seasonings of the sauce. You could use chilies or anchovies, peppers, even chickpeas. Let's do soups. A 28-ounce can of tomato plus a can of vegetable or chicken broth and any seasonings you like add up to a fast soup. You could puree them all together and just heat. You could make the soup more substantial by adding canned beans or leftover vegetables. For a Moroccan-style soup, season the mix with cumin and coriander, some real paprika, cinnamon, garlic, and lots of onion. For an American-style corn chowder, add a lot of corn, onion, some diced-up sweet peppers, and fresh herbs to taste. I also like a tad of cream. Tomatoes and cream were made for each other. I think you get the idea. Make a 28-ounce can of tomatoes into a vegetable main dish by browning together in a big skillet, equal amounts of onion, an equal amount of potatoes, some member of the cabbage family, you know, like Brussels sprouts or cabbage or cauliflower, and then an equal amount of greens. Now, once the onions are golden, add some white wine and boil it off. I sometimes also throw in some balsamic vinegar here. And if you want some meat in it, throw a little diced ham in at this point. Now stir in the 28-ounce can of tomatoes. Simmer everything until the potatoes are tender. And you're home free. Now serve that over rice or couscous, and you've got a great meal. So try cooking with tomatoes. Stock up on 28-ounce cans of tomatoes. Remember to buy only whole tomatoes in juice, not anything that's been pureed or crushed. And join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about food, enjoying it, buying it, cooking it, and about eating out, entertaining, health, and travel. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today, we are looking at some of the unexpected dimensions of taste with Diane Ackerman. Diane's a naturalist, poet, and author of A Natural History of the Senses. Her most recent book is Deep Play. Of all the senses, taste is the most intimate. We actually make the thing we're tasting a part of our bodies. Now, obviously, taste isn't only about what goes on in our mouths. It's about our culture. So today we are diving into the world of the senses. Mark Bittman writes the minimalist column in the New York Times. He streamlines recipes to get us to cook more at home. Today, he has one of the handiest tricks to have up your sleeve for quick meals, red pepper puree. Hong Kong is a mecca for food lovers. Our regular contributor, John Willoughby, has spent some time there of late, and he has some advice. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner talks to us about what to consider when thinking about your kitchen floor. And as every week, the second half of the show is all yours. It's our time to talk. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with my favorite wanderers, Jane and Michael Stern, who roam the country looking for good home-style eating. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Two places you two can't seem to stay away from. One place is Vermont, and the other place is Chicago. And I feel as though we have just scratched the surface of Chicago. So any other discoveries other than hot dogs?
Well, you may think that we are hot dog megalomaniacs, but In fact, if you want great, really great corned beef, we've got a place in Chicago named Manny's. Manny's is an old-time Chicago cafeteria where the minute you walk into the place, the aroma, that kind of pickled, spicy aroma of hot corned beef wallops you. And your taste buds start going, I mean, I can't help but salivate. The problem is that there is usually a long line waiting there for lunch. So you wait and you wait and you get to the station and you get these piled high corned beef sandwiches. Interestingly, the corned beef in Chicago, at Manny's in particular, is cut very differently than it is cut in New York. In other words, in New York, when you get a corned beef sandwich, it's cut quite thick, and you get these big, thick, brisket-like pieces. Mm-hmm. At Manny's, as is more typical of Chicago, it is sliced as thin as prosciutto. Therefore, it is absolutely essential that the corned beef be served and sandwiched within seconds of it being cut, lest it dry out. And that's the way it is at Manny's. You order a corned beef sandwich, wham, it goes between the two slices of really good sour seeded rye, and on the side, to accompany this great corned beef sandwich, you get one or two potato latkes that are to die for.
With the bread and the hot corned beef?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, just God forbid you shouldn't have enough carbohydrates on your plate. But I think when Michael said wham, that's the operative word, because Manny's is kind of like getting a wonderful culinary punch between the eyes when you walk in. It's a very big, noisy, boisterous room. I think you could certainly photograph a We Are the World poster there, because every ethnic mix that is represented in greater Chicagoland has a tray and is lining up for corned beef, whether you're a Jew, an Italian, Irish, Black, Puerto Rican, Mexican. I mean, everybody goes to Manny's for corned beef. And it's also the place where the mayor is sitting side by side with the criminal, but I shouldn't say that, with the parole officer and the, you know, local image consultant and the, you know, the shoe salesman from the big shoe store across the street. It's like what they used to say about Times Square being the crossroads of the world. I think Manny's is the crossroad of Chicago, but oddly enough, it isn't mentioned in most guidebooks to Chicago. It's really a place that insiders know.
So if you don't want corned beef, what else have they got?
In fact, they have a very large menu, and there are specials every single day. Corned beef is what we love there, but if you go there Wednesday, they have their homemade chicken pot pie. Every Thursday, if you get there early enough, because they always run out, they make an oxtail stew, and I mean from scratch. The guy who runs Manny's told us about the 8 hours it takes him to make this oxtail stew, and it is unbelievably succulent. They have knishes. They have chicken soup with matzo balls or kreplach. It's basically a Jewish place, but with something for everyone.
Yeah, I think everybody, when they walk through the doors at Manny's, is Jewish, whether you want to be or not. I mean, Farmer's Chop Suey, which I haven't seen on a menu in 25 years, which is pot cheese with vegetables cut up on it.
And the most busy day of the year at Manny's, the Jewish cafeteria on the outskirts of Chicago, is St. Patrick's Day, because everyone goes there for the corned beef.
Okay, Manny's, Chicago, again. Thank you both.
Again.
Going back where a woman knows the way to treat a man. And people are friendly with no hidden plan. It is the best in the Midwest. It is a real down city, full of good folks who come from home. When I get back, I'll never roam far from my little shy town. Goodbye, farewell, woman, I will see you later.
Shane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. They're here every week, and every week you can get their restaurant finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Minimalist music for a minimalist cook. Mark Bittman writes the minimalist column for the New York Times. Every week he takes a look at a particular recipe, and he streamlines it for the everyday cook. Hi, Mark.
How you doing, Lynn? Great to be here.
So what's on your mind this week?
Well, and what I'm doing is I'm making a couple of purees that are more or less all-purpose purees with things that are commonly around the house but which people don't use as much as they might. Chief among these is sun-dried tomatoes.
I think it's replaced the Spanish olive
as the ingredient that sits in the pantry and no one knows what to do with.
Exactly.
They don't taste that great when you eat them out of the jar. I mean, they're okay, but they do have a really interesting, strong flavor. And if you puree them with a little garlic and basil, some lemon juice, and maybe pinoles, almost make a pesto out of them, but using sun-dried tomatoes in place of the basil, you get a tapenade-like thing that really is great on crackers, but also stirred into rice, on pasta, served with vegetables as a dip, again, like tapenade. And it becomes this kind of all-purpose stuff, condiment that you can keep around and use in a bunch of different ways. It also keeps for a long, long time.
Just to explain, when you say tapenade, you mean that garlic and olive paste that you find in the Mediterranean, right?
That's exactly what
yeah.
I mean.
And so this is replacing the olives, and it's the sun-dried tomatoes with pine nuts and garlic and all this other good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of Mediterranean preparations like this, where you take, semi-preserved foods, dried foods, brined foods, whatever, and grind them into a paste and then use them to flavor whatever. And sun-dried, that's the legitimate use for sun-dried tomatoes. This is not some Americanism here. This is something that, that really is done in the Mediterranean. And it's a great use. It's probably the best use for sun-dried tomatoes.
Okay, so we've now taken care of this jar of sun-dried tomatoes that's been sitting there for Lord knows how long.
Well, let's just back up for one second on
that,
because not everybody has jars of them. Many people have, as I did for a number of years, little dried pieces of shoe leather that are called sun-dried tomatoes.
Yeah.
They're not even in jars. And I just want to point out that the thing to do with those is to soak them in very, very hot water for a half an hour or an hour, so that they plump up, and then combine them with olive oil, and now you've got basically what you find in the jars. Just for those of you who have those little shriveled up things sitting around instead of the jars.
Well, that's great. Some other ideas?
Well, the other thing that I like to do very much, and maybe this strikes more of a chord with people, I don't know, is red pepper puree. And that is roasted red peppers just pureed with some olive oil and salt. And that is a flavor that's just from heaven. You get that charred flavor in the red peppers, and it marries perfectly with good olive oil. And then there's just a zillion uses for that. I mean, now you can make omelets, pasta sauces, spread on pizzas, any kind of vegetables, a little bit on some just lightly broiled or steamed fish. I mean, anything. It's so good.
Now, how do you roast your peppers?
Well, there are many ways, so it's certainly a legitimate question. I tried a lot of different ways, and I wound up settling on lining a roasting pan with tin foil that overlapped the edges by a large amount so that I didn't have to do cleanup, and then roast the peppers until they're black, and then I fold the tin foil over the peppers so they steam, which makes them much easier to peel. So I kind of tried to combine two or three steps at once there.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it works very, very well.
Because I've messed up the burners on my stove now for a very long time doing these puppies.
Well, just put it
in the roasting pan, and then you can clean up easily, too.
Right, right. Well, the burner on the stove is good for one pepper, I suppose. But if you're going to try to do four or six, you're just going to be there for an hour standing there with a pepper on a fork. I mean, I think most people have better things to do. Certainly you do, Lynn.
Well, yeah, to talk to you. Hey,
Thanks,
and we'll talk next month.
Okay, take care.
Mark Bittman writes the minimalist column in the New York Times and is author of the award-winning How to Cook Everything. You can get his recipe for red pepper puree on our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Coming up, Diane Ackerman on Taste as Sensuality and Culture, A Traveler's Guide to the Best Meals in Hong Kong with John Willoughby, and your calls. Get on the line. The number is 1-800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at target.com. In her book, A Natural History of the Senses, Diane Ackerman points out that taste is the most intimate of the senses. We actually take the thing we're tasting into our bodies. That's pretty intimate. But taste is many things. It's pure sensual pleasure and it's pain. Think about eating chilies. It's cultural. One cuisine's joy is another's taboo. It's judgmental. We're always saying something tastes good or something tastes bad. Taste plays Russian roulette. Consider Japan's poisonous pufferfish that tastes so fine, diners risk their lives to eat it. Diane Ackerman is a naturalist and poet who's explored the many facets of taste, and in her new book, Deep Play, explores the world of play. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Diane, your new book is called Deep Play. Define deep play for me.
Well, I think everyone knows what play is. Play really saturates every element of our lives, especially our eating and cooking lives. But deep play is the ecstatic form of play, and it's when people play at something to such an extent that they lose track of time, that it becomes rapturous and deeply satisfying. It has its own rules. The rest of life just disappears, and they perfect themselves. They become the best version of themselves. As a result, we spend our lives searching for these transcendent moments, and it's really what explains thrill-seeking, creativity, religion. Deep play is something that is profoundly human, and it could be something like a game of soccer, if that's how you feel about it, but it could also be something like cooking, or it could be stamp collecting. It isn't the event, it's the attitude that you bring to it.
Well, let's talk about an earlier book you did,
okay.
A Natural History of the Senses.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in that book that taste always has double meanings.
Yes. When we say that I don't have a taste for it, we mean that it in some very complicated way doesn't fit into the preferences in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can say that it doesn't taste good to me, which is the more strict version of taste. Or we can refer to somebody's artistic taste, by which we mean something that is more refined and esoteric and comes from long study. We use taste in many different ways because it's fundamental to our biology. It is one of the elements of our lives that we are born with and will keep for the entire extent of our lives. We will always relish it, or we will protect ourselves with it because things will taste bad and we'll know not to eat them.
Mm-hmm.
It will nourish us. It will help us socialize. It will help us form bonds with loved ones, with strangers. It will provide a wonderful arena of play for us. It will figure so importantly in our lives that it makes sense that we should just extrapolate from that and apply it in other fields as well. We do that with vision, for example. I see where you're coming from.
Same idea.
Same idea.
Except when we're tasting, literally tasting, we're making something a part of our bodies.
Yes.
Yeah, and why is it in this country, not in most other Western cultures, why is it in this country we have such a love-hate relationship with food?
Wow, there are so many answers to that. First of all, there's the puritanical answer. You're not supposed to have too much fun doing anything, but especially you're not supposed to rejoice in your senses, because if you are found to be indulging yourself or playing with your senses, it's like being caught in some erotic play. You're very naughty, and you're not supposed to do that. And anyway, aren't we supposed to be straight-edged and working and goal-oriented, and what is all this nonsense? We use food as an instrument of punishment so often in our culture. We give treats if somebody has done something well, or we send them to bed without dinner if they haven't. But we do it in a more insidious way, too. We have standards of beauty that involve a kind of anorexia that has gotten to such a point that when I went to dinner the other night, there were a lot of teens there who were graduating from high school, and they were dressed up beautifully, and they were in an Italian restaurant, and they were going off to the prom afterwards. And when they left, I discovered the plates were still full. They couldn't afford to eat. They had to look thinner than they were, whatever that was.
Yeah, yeah.
So, unfortunately, food has become politicized turned into some curious element of beauty in our culture, and it's unfortunate that has happened.
And we're so image-driven.
We're very image-driven, yeah, and very fashion-oriented, and of course, you know how many fashions there are in food.
Cravings. Where do cravings come from? Is it all physiological?
I think a lot of craving is physiological, and some of it is social. We develop a taste for whatever happens to be in fashion because it would be the chic thing to do. But let's forget about that for the moment. Biologically, we crave what our body needs to exist. So we crave sugar, we crave fat, we crave all of those yummy things that we know aren't very good for us because there was a time in our history when that craving kept us alive. We didn't have refined sugar, but we had to search for the fruits and the vegetables that would have sugar in them to fuel our bodies. And we developed a real passionate craving for these things because we couldn't get very much of it in any one place, and so we had to keep looking. Now, our bodies haven't really evolved as fast as our culture, and so we can produce very intensively sweet things that overwhelm our senses, and we just want more and more of them, but of course that's not what we evolved to be doing. In the case of something like chocolate, for example, there are many theories about why we crave it. It's certainly interesting that throughout history, sweethearts have given chocolate to one another. And I think part of the reason is not just that it reminds you of childhood and it illuminates all of your senses. It's sweet, it's fatty, it's gooey, it melts in your mouth, all of that. Chocolate contains phenylethylamine, which is a chemical that the body produces naturally when we're in love. It's an amphetamine-like chemical. And so when you give your sweetheart chocolate, you are revving them up. You're giving them a little taste of love. And you are giving them these taste treats. And if you've also brought some perfume and some flowers, you're covering most of the senses there. Mm-hmm. You don't have far mm-hmm. to go.
So you're saying that chocolate reproduces the drug state of being
in love. Exactly, exactly. And this is why, traditionally, so many jilted people go home and pig out on chocolate.
So now I can justify being a chocoholic.
Oh, if you give me time, I can justify most of your taste cravings, I think.
Diane, thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Diane Ackerman is author of Deep Play and A Natural History of the Senses. Every traveling food lover faces the same challenge when they get to a new town. How to find out where the locals who love good food go to eat. We solved the problem for Hong Kong. Yeah, granted, it's a bit of a trip, but Hong Kong is a mecca for anyone who loves great food. Food writer John Willoughby has been spending some time there, and he's kind enough to bring us a report. Hi, John.
How are you today, Lynn?
I'm just swell. Now, you've been eating in Hong Kong.
That's right.
Yeah, and what I want from you is kind of an eater's guide. Where should we go? I mean, this city has thousands of restaurants. Where do you begin?
Well, last count, there were 6,000 restaurants in Hong Kong. So,
oh, my God.
And they come and go, and it's very hard to know where to eat. But I think you can't go wrong if you go to four specific areas. There are the very high-end hotels, which, unlike hotels in the U.S., which until recently didn't have great food, in Hong Kong they have fantastic foods in the high-end hotels. And then there are two areas on the island itself, one called Lan Kwai Fong and one called Soho, which they took from New York, but there it means south of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And then on the Kowloon Peninsula, which is the part of China that has always been a part of Hong Kong, which uh-huh. is on the mainland, there's an area called Kowloon City, which is where the old airport used to be, which is now an incredible restaurant area. So I would say if you go to those four places during your visit, you'll get some incredible food and you'll see a whole range of different levels of food, too.
Where do I actually go to eat? Like, I've heard about huge restaurants that seat hundreds and hundreds of people. Are they good?
Well, some are good and some are not, as you might suspect. There are a couple on Hong Kong Island that have been there forever and that are still unbelievably good. One is called the Hunan Garden. And I know that sounds like a kind of second-rate Chinatown restaurant in the U.S.,
yeah.
but it's actually an amazingly good Hunan restaurant. The food you get there is very spicy, but beautifully prepared, beautifully served. I've eaten there, I think, 5 times, and I've never had a meal that was less than spectacular. And there's another restaurant that is also right in Hong Kong Island, which is famous for its roast goose. And it also has many other preparations. But if you go there and get the roast goose, you will be having one of the great dishes of Hong Kong. It's called Yung Kee, Y-U-N-G-K-E-E. And again, it's a huge and very old-style restaurant, but the food has always been great there.
Okay, what about smaller places?
There are many hole-in-the-wall places. It's hard to specifically choose one. There's everything from the Dai Pai Dong, which are the noodle shops in the streets, to just small coffee shops everywhere you go. It's hard to choose those, but there's a new phenomenon in Hong Kong, which I hadn't seen until my visit last fall, which is there are now a lot of sort of middle-range restaurants. There have always been the very luxurious restaurants and the sort of street-level restaurants, but now there are quite a few middle-range restaurants, which I think has to do with the reaction to the Asian financial crisis. And one of the most popular is a restaurant called China Lan Kwai Fong, which is in the Lan Kwai Fong district on Hong Kong Island. And there's a big retro boom in Hong Kong now, sort of going back to the romance of Shanghai at the turn of the century. And this is a Shanghainese restaurant. It's very elaborate with white slip covers on the chairs and mahogany bar. And it's quite beautiful. And the food is a new kind of food. It's what they call Nouvelle Chinese Regional. And the chef there is very good. And it's a middle-range restaurant. It's about, you know, $25 a person, but the food is quite amazing. And it's a lot of young Chinese go there. It's very popular with young, sort of hip Chinese. And you get dishes there. Like when I was there, I had a spicy salted crab claw and a crispy roast pigeon, both of which were just out of this world.
Oh, I'm getting very hungry.
The food is spectacular.
Is street food safe?
Street food, you know, it is generally safe. I've never gotten sick in Hong Kong. I know other people who have. Hong Kong is really, you know, I like to say it's a British city with a Chinese heart. The hygiene is very good in Hong Kong. And a lot of the sort of street-level restaurants, particularly noodle shops, are pretty safe.
Now, mainland China took over Hong Kong, and my understanding is that Mao never really did any favors for Chinese cuisine. So what's happened to the food in Hong Kong since the takeover?
Well, fortunately, not much. I think that the Asian financial crisis has been a much bigger influence than the takeover by the mainland Chinese. As a matter of fact, you don't see any changes whatsoever. Even the Chinese army is not present on the streets at all. And they made a specific and conscious decision not to make many changes. The building where the British police were always housed was called the Prince of Wales Building. And everyone assumed that as soon as they took over, that was going to become the Mao Zedong Building. But they have even left the name of that the same, and the troops are kept inside so the people don't see them, and it is still a city with more street-level energy than any place I've ever been, and it really, as far as we can tell, hasn't changed at all.
The troops are probably out there eating so well, they don't want to do anything.
They're too busy eating.
Exactly.
That's what they say about Hong Kong. The only thing more important to a Hong Kong person than money is food, and I think that might be true. It's unbelievable.
Is there a signature dish in Hong Kong?
I think that there are many signature dishes for the various regional cuisines. One of the things that is nice about Hong Kong is that they have preserved the regional cuisines. There's some fusion between regional cuisines and Western food, but the regional cuisines themselves have stayed pretty much the same, and there's 7 or 8 of them, and I think each of them would have a particular signature dish. And I think the way to find these is to go to the Kowloon City area of Hong Kong. Now, this is where the old airport was, and the airport has since moved to an island off of Hong Kong. They have a brand-new huge airport. And so all the area around the airport has been taken over by block after block of small regional Chinese restaurants. And you can get some amazing food there for not very much money at all. I ate at a place called the Peace Restaurant, which is a Shanghainese restaurant. We had hairy crab. We had red fried meat cooked in soy sauce. We had drunken chicken. We had sweet pig's knuckles, which really were much better than they sound. and they have a special kind of Shanghainese bread, which they bake and then fry, which gives it an amazing texture. So I think if you went to the various, if you go to the various regional restaurants, you'll get their signature dishes.
John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. It's been fun.
Food writer John Willoughby contributes to national publications and is co-author of License to Grill. You can find John's Hong Kong restaurant advice on our website at splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It's time to talk. The lines are open. The number is 1-800-537-5252. Get on the line. Give us a call. Anything goes. We're going to get to the phones. We've got Eve calling. Hi, Eve.
Hi. We moved to Spencer, West Virginia last fall and went out in the woods and gathered morels.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah. Oh, although I spent more time looking for poison ivy than morels. But I need to know, I need suggestions for what to do with them besides just deep frying.
I never thought about deep frying morel. That's a great idea, though.
That's what people do around here.
Oh, but hey, you know, there is that old business, you know, you can fry anything, it's going to taste good.
Yeah.
You can fry nothing, it'll taste good.
Yeah, oh, it's great, but I'd like something else.
Morels always remind me of hazelnuts. And there's a way they're done in France that is really lovely, because the morels themselves are so delicate, you don't want to hit them over the head with a lot of any of the flavoring.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the ways you can do it. Sauté them in a little bit of butter, not too much,
mm-hmm.
and sauté them with a little bit of minced up shallot or garlic, depending on what you can get locally.
Okay.
And then toward the end of the sauté, add some crushed, toasted hazelnuts, because the hazelnuts and that little hint of garlic bring out lovely flavors in the morels. And if you want to get fancy, you could add a tad of cream to the pan and just cook that down a little bit.
Okay.
It should be great. And you put that over, let's say, scrambled eggs on a plate?
Mm-hmm.
Or put that over a piece of coarse bread that you've toasted?
Mm-hmm.
And just spoon that over it, or put it over pasta or rice, and it's out of this world. Or eat it on its own.
Yeah.
I mean, see how you like that, because the morels are so luscious.
Well, I know. I don't want to dilute them too much.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
do you have them growing sort of all around your place?
No, actually, we went on four-wheelers way back up off in the woods.
So you know what I think you're really doing? You really have them in your backyard, but you don't want anybody to know about that.
No, I wish I had them in my backyard.
No, but yeah, really, I think of what you pay for morels when you're in a city.
Uh-huh.
They're outrageously expensive. You're really lucky.
You know, the other thing is that they did have a lot of bugs in them. I mean, the people we went with said soak them in salt water
to
get
a good
the
idea.
Bugs out.
Yeah.
But there were millions of these teeny tiny little bugs.
Oh, not nice.
And, yeah, I'm not even sure I got all of them rinsed off. But, like, how long do you think you really ought to soak and then start rinsing?
I think I'd soak for about a half hour, 45 minutes, and then I'd rinse like the devil.
Yeah,
I really would. Yeah, because you know they're sort of hollow inside.
They are very hollow inside.
Yeah, and it's part of the problem with wild mushrooms, but mm-hmm. people are philosophical about it. Now for everybody else who's listening out there, I am not recommending you eat bugs. Don't anybody get upset, please. No, but really, salted water and then give them a really good rinse inside and out.
Yeah.
And then I would say raise your eyes to heaven and go and sauté and enjoy every bite of them.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
And we're not asking you where you found them. You notice this? We're not asking for a location because this is precious stuff. We're respecting your privacy.
I just wrote on the back of the four-wheeler. I couldn't tell you where they were.
Hey, enjoy them.
Hold on tight. Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Okay.
Now for our weekly trivia question. It's a travel question. Where's the most unexpected place to sample the wares of today's hottest chefs? A hint, it's in the United States. Again, the question is, where's the most unexpected place to sample the wares of today's hottest chefs? Well, we're going to have the solution in a moment, as well as kitchen designer Deborah Krasner looking at kitchen floors and more of your calls. So get on the line at 1-800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 1-800-537-5252. But before getting back to the phones, I have got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, where is the most unexpected place to sample the wares of today's hottest chefs?
Fever, Las Vegas, turning day into night, time turning night into daytime. If you see it once, you'll never be the same again.
The answer is Las Vegas. Every chef who has ever gotten more than 5 seconds of publicity has opened a restaurant there of late. You've got Jean-Georges Van Gerichten with Prime. Emeril, who's everywhere these days, has got a seafood place. Le Cirque has a clone. You've got the Charlies, as in Palmer and Trotter. Jean-Louis, formerly of the Watergate, and Wolfgang Puck, who started the whole Las Vegas push. I've probably forgotten a few. Now, this is all under the heading of a town that's trying to attract more than gamblers. They want families. Of course, I don't know how many families can afford the price at these eateries. You've got to hit the jackpot to have dinner.
Viva! Viva! Las Vegas!
Okay, enough. Let's get back to the phones. Paul's calling. Paul, what's happening?
Lynn, I'm a school teacher in the New York City Public Schools, and I work with 9 other wonderful teachers in a very special program that we've been running a number of years, and I like to find a time for us all to celebrate, and we go out to dinner sometimes, but I now have room in my apartment and would like to entertain for these, what will be 10 or 11 people.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is we all have to leave work together, and arrive at my apartment, and I have to be able to serve a meal then for 10 people, not having been here to get everything ready ahead of time. And I'm wondering if you have some suggestions on how I could do that.
This is what I would do, and it's a menu I've done in some variation before. I would build the menu around a braised lamb dish, because you can do that a night ahead. You can stick it in the fridge. Now, you know, there's going to be that time where you'll stick the pot on the stove and have it coming, heating up. But that's when you pour the wine and you pass around some radishes with some fresh goat cheese. Let everybody dip those raw radishes into the fresh goat cheese, and they're not going to care if it takes 20 minutes to heat up the lamb.
Sure.
So what you want to do is you want to make essentially a lamb stew, but we're not going to call it a lamb stew. We're going to call it a Moroccan-inspired lamb braise. And you're going to put into it small potatoes, you know, that are in season now, and small young onions, the ones that are about an inch and a half in diameter, and some green beans and carrots. And you want to flavor it with things like lots of garlic and cumin and coriander and tomato and paprika. It'd be luscious. I mean, you just, and it's a Moroccan-inspired kind of thing. And then with that, you can do this really neat thing with couscous. Because the idea is you're going to have the lamb, you're going to have a starch, you're going to have a salad, you're going to have a dessert.
Mm-hmm.
And it's simple, really simple. Couscous is great because couscous you can buy and just moisten it with some kind of liquid. Keep sifting it between your hands, you know, rubbing it between your hands.
I have cooked with it once or twice.
Right. You don't even have to really cook it. It will absorb and it will get fluffy. You could eat it right like that. But the other thing you can do is pull it and put it in a shallow pan, seal it with foil, and you can pop it in the oven at about 350 or 400 for 20 minutes just before you're going to serve it with the lamb. And it fluffs, and it's dynamite. And you can get real fancy. Throw some cinnamon sticks and throw some raisins into it.
Okay.
Okay. Now, by the way, the lamb dish, you could do it with chicken, too, if you wanted to.
Okay.
Same idea. Same idea. Now, the salad, the night before or even 2 days before, wash your salad, spin it absolutely dry, roll it up in paper towels, stick it in plastic bags, put it in the fridge. It'll crisp.
Okay.
It'll be gorgeous. You can make a dressing ahead. Have it in a shaker jar.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a big bowl of salad. You've got couscous. You've got this luscious lamb stew with all the veg. More veg than lamb. You could do it with chicken. And then dessert, strawberries are so nice now.
Just pick some rhubarb out of a garden we have in the country.
Oh.
And I wonder if that would be...
That would be great. Why don't you cook the rhubarb up with some sugar and cinnamon?
Yeah.
And then put that in little bowls or in a big bowl and cover it with sliced strawberries.
Okay.
And sprinkle those with sugar. And that's your dessert with whipped cream on the side.
That would also work.
Yeah, and that's your dinner party.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Take care.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Stuart's calling. Hey, Stuart, hi. How are you?
Hi, Lynn. This is Stuart in Topeka, Kansas.
Uh-huh.
And I listen to you on KKSU 580 from Kansas State University.
Hey, that's great. Okay.
And my mom loves to buy things at the store that are on sale and bring them over. And she brought over some artichokes. And I have no idea how to cook them.
And they're really ornery things. I mean, when you think about it, if you've never dealt with an artichoke, it's rather like struggling with an octopus.
I've never cooked one before, but I've watched them do it on TV a few times, and I just don't remember at all on how to cook them in any way.
Okay, are they big ones?
Yeah, they're medium size.
Okay, here's the deal. The first thing you want to do is figure out what you can eat in an artichoke and what you can't eat in an artichoke. Now,
okay.
Now, generally what you can't eat because it has maybe has a thorn in it is the very top of each leaf.
Right.
So what you do is you go around the outside of the artichoke with a pair of scissors and you cut off like the top quarter of every leaf.
Okay.
And then you can cut off like the top quarter of the entire artichoke.
Okay.
You're not losing anything. Now, you know, in the leaf is that lovely succulent stuff you want to pull out with your teeth after the artichoke is cooked. So you leave the leaves in. Now, if you open up the artichoke, you know, push everything aside and open it up a little bit and look down into the center of it, you're going to see some very pale leaves. And then inside those pale leaves, you'll see purple leaves. Purple
okay.
leaves are not good.
Okay.
So you go in with a knife or a spoon, you get rid of the purple leaves.
Alrighty.
Now, underneath the purple leaves is one other thing you don't want to eat. It's the choke. Some of us affectionately refer to it as the fuzz. Now, there are two ways of getting rid of fuzz. One is boil the artichoke. After it's cooked, you can just go in and scoop the fuzz out with a spoon, and what's under it is the artichoke bottom, which is the steak. It is the rib steak of the artichoke. It is the best. The other thing people do if they're going to cook the artichoke stuffed or whatever is, they scrape with a spoon to pull that fuzz off when it's raw. You just reach in.
Okay.
Take your pick. Now, you can do a lot of things with the artichoke once you've got it together like this. One thing is that you could just drop it in boiling water that has salt and a lot of acid in it because it darkens.
Okay.
So you can put vinegar in the water or lemon. And you boil the artichokes maybe 20, 30, 40 minutes until you can easily pierce the bottom of them with a knife.
Okay.
Drain them upside down, and then you just put your favorite dressing in the center.
Like salad dressing?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, everything from ranch to Italian to, you know, just oil, vinegar, herbs, and whatever, and garlic. And then you pluck off the leaf, and you reach inside because the artichoke becomes a little bowl.
Right.
And you just dip the end of that leaf in there, and then you sort of suck out all the luscious flesh inside that leaf. And then when you get all done, there's the bottom. that's cupping the last of the dressing that has started to permeate the bottom and make it taste even better than it tasted before. And then you eat that with a knife and fork.
Do I cut most of the stem off?
Yes. Oh, if it has a stem, yeah. But you can boil, you can peel the stems and boil them right along with the artichoke.
Oh, okay. That's right. I saw that before. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the way you handle an artichoke. It's real easy.
What kind of other things can you put in there besides salad dressing?
Well, what you could do, too, is you could put things like crab salad, chicken salad and serve it as a main dish.
Okay.
You could also handle them raw, get rid of the choke raw. And then you can stuff between the leaves and in the center a mixture of salami and parsley and garlic and mint.
And, oh, that sounds delicious,
and
too.
And put them in a baking dish, sprinkle them with olive oil and white wine, lightly cover them, and bake them for an hour at 400 degrees.
Okay. We have all those ingredients. We might do that tonight.
You are going to have artichokes up the kazoo for the next couple of weeks. You can just have a feast.
Yeah, I think they're on sale here in Kansas.
It's the time of year.
Okay.
This is a great time of year for artichokes.
I've never tried them before. I think we'll try them tonight.
You go out there and do artichokes. Call us. Let us know how they work out. If you run into a problem, send up a flare. We'll try to get back to you.
Thanks, Lynn. I really enjoy your show. I listen every week.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
And thanks to everybody else who's called today. Remember, you can get us anytime. Put this number on your fridge, 1-800-537-5252. Deborah Krasner is a kitchen designer who lives in Vermont and works all over the United States. About once a month, Deborah drops by to talk about kitchens. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
What's on your mind this month?
Actually, I've been thinking a lot about floors. It seems to me that there's a real trend in floors that we need to look at closely, and that is floors that are hard underfoot. My sense of things is that floors should be soft underfoot because you stand on them for a long time in the kitchen.
Here, here. Absolutely. Okay, so, but we're seeing all of these stone floors and tile floors. What do you think?
And they're beautiful. They're just beautiful. And if you really love the way they look and you can't imagine anything else, then you need to correct that hardness. And there are a number of things that you can do. In industrial settings, they use something called anti-fatigue mats. And you can take an industrial anti-fatigue mat, which is out of rubber, and put that on the place on the floor where you stand the most.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've just recently seen rather beautiful 50s-looking retro swirly-colored anti-fatigue mats that are made for the beauty industry. And you can get those and put them on your floor, again, in front of a sink or in front of the counter where you do most of your prep work.
Uh-huh.
And that will counteract some of the problems of a hard floor. However, if you're starting from scratch, you can start with a soft floor. There are a lot of different alternatives on the market that really make it comfortable underfoot. My most favorite of those materials is cork, which has come back as a flooring material after not being available in this country for a very long time. Cork is, of course, from the cork tree, and cork flooring is permeated with polyurethane so that it doesn't crumble the way cork bulletin boards do.
Mm-hmm.
And the importer has a picture of a cork floor installed in the airport, so we know that it can stand up to heavy traffic.
How do you clean it, though?
Well, you clean it just like any other floor because it's a plastic surface, essentially. You just damp mop it. But because it's cork, it has the beauty of a natural material. It comes in natural color, sort of beigey,
mm-hmm.
wood color. But it's also available stained in a really wide variety of beautiful colors so that you can have a deep red kind of cordovan floor, if that's what you like. Or I've seen a beautiful installation of white stained and black stained cork tiles alternating like an old checkerboard floor in a Dutch still life. And it looks gorgeous because the quality of the texture of the cork makes those colors rather transparent rather than opaque. And so it has beautiful depth.
That sounds lovely. Is it expensive?
It's relatively expensive, but it's also relatively long-lived, so I think it's a good buy for the money. Other alternatives also have cork in them. Real linoleum, as opposed to the stuff that we often call linoleum but is really vinyl,
mm-hmm.
real linoleum is made from a mixture of cork and linseed oil and other binders. And that's also newly available in the United States after not being around for a very long time. And it's made in Germany in a wide variety of beautiful, soft colors. it can be mosaicked, cut in pieces, and applied in a mosaic pattern. That is, pieces of different colors can be cut out and laid in a pattern on a floor, or it can be just solid one-color linoleum, or it can be alternated like a checkerboard or borders in a rug. It's really beautiful, and that, again, is pretty expensive, but long-lived, and it's available at ecological stores.
What about something like cushioned vinyl? How do you
feel
about that?
Cushioned vinyl is great. I mean, it's a really good, durable material. It was made for the job of doing a kitchen floor, and it does it well. I think the real issue with vinyl has to do with the colors and the patterns. An awful lot of it is fake something, you know, fake marble, fake wood, tile. And some of those are just beautiful fakes and really work, and some of them are obvious fakes and less wonderful. So I think it's more a question of looking hard at the wide variety of patterns that are on the market.
What about wood?
Wood is a great material for flooring. The only problem is in front of the sink. Any place where wood gets wet regularly tends to rot, and it certainly wears off the finish. There are a number of things you can do about that. You can either just resign yourself to refinishing your kitchen floor regularly. You can put a floor cloth, which is a painted canvas rug that is water impermeable. You can use just a rag rug that you throw in the washing machine every few days, but that will catch most of the moisture before it hits the floor. Or you can do an insert of ceramic or marble tile just in that area in front of the sink that's going to get a lot of moisture, although then you're then making a hard place on your soft floor.
And then you put the soft mat on top of that.
Okay. Right.
Hey, Deborah, thank you.
My pleasure.
Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner works nationally out of her Vermont studio and is author of Kitchens for Cooks. Well, that's it for today, folks. Thanks for being with us. Do join us again next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with a thought about the sense of smell from Helen Keller. Even as I think of smells, my nose is full of scents that start awake sweet memories of summers gone and ripening fields far away. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry from Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials. 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality, heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get a copy of the Stern's Roadside Food Finds and information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website at splendidtable.org. While you're visiting, be sure to check out the Splendid Table store. It's an ever-changing collection of the stuff you can find in my kitchen. Well, okay, so it's a little bit more organized. Anyway, take a look. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.